This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. The legal and regulatory environment of business. Lecture 3, delivered on June 9th of 2008. The title of this lecture is Constitutional Law.
Tonight, constitutional law. Before I begin that subject, I do want to cover a few last points about the topic of my last lecture, the legal system of the United States. Specifically, I want to give mention, at least, to alternative dispute resolution methods, ADRs, alternative dispute resolution methods. Courts are not the only place that disputes can be solved. You can obviously solve disputes in the back alley. You can solve disputes by trashing people on the internet. But if we want to be civilized, but we don't want to use the courts, we have alternatives to the courts. In the 1920s, Congress passed the Federal Arbitration Act. This essentially gave legal validity to resolutions that were not made by courts. Congress said it is acceptable, it is legal to use institutions, individuals, and methods other than the courts to accomplish resolution of disputes. Now, what had happened was there is an ancient principle. Every person should have the right to his or her day in courts. And certainly there is a long, long tradition of that, although it is a tainted tradition. And I am considering putting up an article that I wrote some time back about a time in history, and that was not the only time, but there have been times in history when the courts have not been available to the common people. In England, that was the case, and it got worse and worse. Through the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, the courts became nothing but the playground of the wealthy. The common people, even the freemen, did not get to go to the courts, those courts lost their legitimacy in a way through that. And perhaps part of what happened in the early 20th century was that there was a recognition that the courts were just getting flooded, overburdened tremendously with a lot of disputes, especially legal disputes between companies. Everyone was going to court. It was very much a litigious time. You hear about that now, like that's modern. No, that's been going on. And so Congress said, okay, we are going to, as a nation, recognize methods other than courts where people can go, companies can go, what have you, and find a way to solve problems. Okay, now the first way, ADR, that I'll bring up is mediation. Mediation is the process whereby the parties to a dispute meet under the auspices of a mediator. The mediator is a facilitator. He does not have binding authority. There are licensing programs and there are a lot of training programs available. A good mediator brings the parties together and knows how to get them to come to the core issues, face those core issues, and get them dealt with. That's what a mediator does. A good mediator is very smart, knows how to get people to work out their differences. The next alternative is what is called arbitration. Now, you might have heard the term binding arbitration. That's redundant. Arbitration in general is binding. And an arbitrator brings the parties together, the parties to a dispute together, allows the parties to present their cases. It is not as formal as a trial. However, there is still the presentation of cases. The arbitrator listens to both sides, and then the arbitrator renders a decision, which is binding. In many cases, these decisions will not be reviewed subsequently by a court. However, they can be in some cases. If a court reviews an arbitrator's decision, it does so de novo, looking at it anew. That would be most likely how a court would look at an arbitrator's decision. The good thing about arbitration is that it does indeed lessen the burden on the courts. Another good thing about arbitration is that because it is less formal, it has in that regard a certain level of invitation to the person or to the aggrieved party who is not formal, who does not have access to fancy lawyers with fancy prices. So in that regard, arbitration is good. In those regards, arbitration is good. However, there is a dark side to arbitration. First, many employers require arbitration in labor disputes. Require that if you have a problem with the employer, you have signed an employment contract that requires that you go to arbitration with your case, which means that you are signing away essentially a fundamental right, the right to have a day in court. Now, it's most definitely the case that courts will look at decisions, but in a large sense, that arbitration clause in an employment contract is a deterrent to your exercising a right that you have otherwise. Another dark side, and I'll speak somewhat off the record here, is that arbitrators are licensed, they're trained, there are federal arbitrators who travel circuits doing their work. There are many, many stories, especially in labor negotiations, where arbitrators, it has been felt by labor that the arbitrators were on the side of the businesses. This has been especially true in recent years. This has been true even here, where there was a deep feeling that when the labor dispute at this school went to arbitration, the arbitrator was on the side of the school, on the side of management from the very beginning. And sure enough, when the decision was made by the arbitrator, it was a decision largely in favor of management. The contract decisions that the arbitrator made is almost a rubber stamp of what the management had written down, with a few minor concessions to labor. Those stories are not uncommon. Arbitrators are essentially bought and paid for shills of industry. Now, is that completely true? No. I have seen arbitrators make decisions that were unfavorable to business. However, most of the time, in my own personal experience, arbitrators are there for the businesses, unless it is a major, major case and it's so obvious that the arbitrator can't avoid doing the right thing. Another alternative is the private trial. A private trial is just like a public trial, except it's a bought and paid for trial by the litigants. They simply hire a judge, and they hire a courtroom. In many cases, it is literally in a courtroom, but it is not a public trial. It is a private trial. Another one, which I have seen, and I was there and I participated. I wasn't a major player. But what is called a mini trial This is not a private trial. This is something very different. A mini trial, the way the one, and I, this is not that unusual, the way the one I was in worked was that the two sides essentially agreed on a panel of executives from both companies. This panel would hear the dispute being presented in fairly formal, not perfectly formal. There were differences. There were. If it had been a trial, it would have been considered flawed. But in a fairly formal environment, evidence was presented. The panel that comprised executives from both companies heard the evidence, found the facts, and rendered judgment, rendered a verdict, essentially a judgment on the matter. And now the interesting thing about this was that I never thought something like this could work, because it would be like two camps. The one corporation's executives on the panel would stand up for their people. The executives on the other side would stand up. It just didn't work out that way. The people on the panel took their responsibilities very seriously, and the decision they came to be honest with you, wasn't completely favorable to either side. It worked out. It was not a bad deal. Now, I'm not all that sure I want to do this way, the way the book explains this, but actually I noticed the book kind of twinkle toes around this a little bit. Have you ever seen the shows on TV like Judge Judy and all those? Yeah. They're not trials. So they're not public trials. So which of these are they? What would you say? Which one of these would be a Judge Judy type of show? There are a lot of those shows on TV. I can't remember some. I've seen different ones pop up. Yeah.
Arbitration.
That is my best shot. The way I would argue it is they're mostly an arbitration with a smell of private trial. Because there's a private trial, because there's obviously money being made here. By Judge Judy doesn't work for free. Neither do any of those people. So there's a private trial aspect, definitely. So it's almost like a hybrid of arbitration and private trial. The decisions are binding. The people enter these trials, quote-unquote, with signed agreements that they will accept the verdict of the judge. And so it's interesting, too, because they are much wilder than a courtroom, okay? However, for the most part, and this is not true in some of these shows, I mean, are just terrible. But many of them, if you get behind the insanity of the people yelling and calling each other names and all that kind of stuff, if you look at the way the judge is thinking, that you will see that it is, generally speaking, these are very well-trained people. They allow for the showmanship that's necessary to keep the TV show interesting. But they also apply rock-solid principles of law. Not just in the judgments, but also in the admission of evidence and in the overall direction that the court will allow the witnesses to take their testimony. So even it's actually masterful, Judge Judy or some of these others, they are masterful in the sense that they know how to make it a show so that it's entertainment with all the yelling and screaming that would never actually go on in most courtrooms. But at the same time, they do know how to keep it to the law, so that the law is being applied in a good way. So don't get the idea that it's all show. If you watch carefully, and you will learn through this course rules of evidence, rules how decision making should be made in a court. And when you go back and watch those shows, you'll say, "Ah, I see what that was all about. Why she did that little trick right there when she cut off the witness. Why she wanted the witness to explain this part." She's actually, in a way, in those kinds of in that sense, the judge is actually serving as more than just a judge. Is actually serving as almost a dual counsel, trying to move the witnesses and the litigants to the proper presentations of evidence. She will ask them questions, inquire of them, and seek the facts from the evidence they present. That's alternative dispute resolutions. And most likely in your lives, you will become a subject of the Federal Arbitration Act of the last century, early in the last century. I believe that was 1922, by the way, but do not quote me on that. The book gives the actual date, the actual year, but it was, but as I said, you will be subject to it. Almost definitely. You sign a contract with almost any employer of any size, you will be agreeing to arbitration with respect to a certain labor disputes. In this regard, and I will return to this later in the course when we get to labor law, there are essentially, in labor law, there are no fault situations where even though you have been injured in a workplace, possibly in a wrongful manner you have been injured, you do not have recourse immediately to the courts. Instead, you are made whole, or at least the attempt is made to make you whole through workers' compensation, which is an insurance program mandated at the state level of employers of a certain size or larger within the state. The companies pay premiums into the workers' comp program for the state, and then when people are injured, those people are paid from this workers' compensation pool. The incentive there for employers is that the fewer accidents that result in compensated injuries they have, the better their premiums are. And there are trigger points that can get a company into all kinds of trouble if it just keeps getting workers injured in its workplace. This is not the only insurance companies have for worker injuries, but it is the largest. And in a sense, this is an alternative that was developed some years ago to litigation. If you hurt yourself in your workplace, you don't have to sue to get made whole. The workers' comp program is just automatic. It not completely automatic, but it is fairly quick. To give you an example, there was a student of mine last semester. He was injured working at a restaurant. He was hurt rather badly working at the restaurant. Workers' comp paid for his injury. On the other hand, just a few weeks ago, I was talking to a woman who works at a large company here in town who said that her secretary had, what was it her secretary did? It was her secretary had gotten stung by a bee. And it had swelled up and it made her wrist immovable. It stung her on the wrist. It was something along that line, and she sought a workers' compensation claim for getting stung by the bee. And she was denied. Now her alternatives are just to let it get over it or to sue the company. But the first thing she had to do was go through workers' comp to see if they would help her with the injury. Her claim was the bee stung her while she was out in the field on company business. The company argued, this is a bee sting, come on. Would she have a case in court? Well, possibly, because it was work-related in the sense that she would not have been in that field where those bees were if she had not been required to as part of her job. So there's some question in this regard as to whether or not the decision by the workers' comp decision was appropriate or not. Nonetheless, okay, enough. That's alternative dispute resolutions. Let us then move on. Constitutional law. Here we go. We're going to try this again. Now that you've read the Constitution, I'm sure you've read it a few times. What? You look ready for me, so okay, fine. Bring it on. Okay, what would you say? Give me one of the rights enumerated in the First Amendment.
freedom of the press.
Good, good. And that one is unusual because, again, as I had mentioned before, that's the only commercial enterprise that is really mentioned anywhere in the Bill of Rights as having, as being recognized as having a right. Journalism has a right. Well, who would have thunk it? Okay. Now, okay, you want to try one? Freedom of speech. Now, again, say that to an extent. Yeah. You can't yell fire in a theater. Recently, as I had mentioned, the Supreme Court declared, judged that child pornography is not freedom of free speech. It has determined in the past that there are other activities that do not constitute free speech. And let me also, in this regard, point out the difference, which the book does not do. I don't think the book even brings this up, but, well, it does in a case, okay. But as an important point, I need this one on your, in your notes. The difference between speech and conduct. Now, by just the very process of bringing that up, I think you can almost conjure the distinction, at least to some extent. So, for example,
I'm going to slap you.
No.
Concentrate, woman. Of course I won't slap you. Chwap! I slapped you. Hey, you're like, this guy, he just slapped me. Well, it's just my freedom of speech. No, that's conduct. That's conduct. Freedom of speech. You run down the street naked. I mean bare-assed. Not a stitch. In the raw.
First time?
Damn, boy, I wish you hadn't said that, because now I'm visualizing. Here we go. Think about it this way, though. Is that, do you see how there's an argument that that's a, you're making, that's speech? You are speaking something. I want my freedom. I want nature back, or something like that. But, is that speech or is that conduct? Yes.
So that's conduct?
Because there is an aspect to it that has certain effect upon others. Okay? So, and this gets into some very complicated issues with performance art. A good example, for some years there was a quote-unquote performance artists. Now, you got to understand that a lot of performance artists are actually lame, talentless idiots. But there is something to be said, unfortunately, sometimes these lame, talentless idiots, their most important contribution is not so much that they have people finally decide that they're lame and talentless, but they also challenge the boundaries of law, and they also make intellectual people think. Even though the person is stupid, he makes you think. It's sort of like Forrest Gump, a dumbass, but he did make you think. So there was this performance artist, she was completely talentless. Her entire act was to strip naked and then smear chocolate all over her nude body while she talked to her audience. That was her thing. And I mean, you know, and there were a lot of artistically minded men who went to her performances, obviously for the artistic value of them. She was very attractive, but that had nothing to do with it. Obviously, you went for the artistic value. Not. But the point there is that there was an aspect of what she was doing that was obscene as hell. She was very much exposing all of her body. She was very much doing it in an erotic way that was appealing to the prurient interests of guys saying, yeah. Was it speech or was it conduct? Think. What would you say? Speech or conduct? It's hard to say. But I want you to be able to start formulating on this because I'm going to challenge you on this as this course goes along. Are any of you familiar with the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe? He did some of the most famous, especially black and white, photographs of celebrities and famous people. You might even recognize some of his photographs. Just amazing. He had an amazing talent. He also did homoerotic art of photography. I mean, some of it just you, unless you're really into that kind of thing, it would make you hurl. And I will not get you too far into the description, but a description. In one photograph, he did a self-photograph in which he had an enormous, giant bullwhip with a diameter on the handle and of some 6 inches. And the photograph was of him standing with his back to the camera. He was naked, and the bullwhip was shoved into his rectum about a foot. And the rest of the bullwhip was hanging out like a tail. Just appalling, shocking, disgusting. I almost lost my lunch. And there were cities where he was banned from showing this photograph because it was just gross. It was sickening. And he said, well, this is homosexual rights. No, it was a type of sadomasochistic homosexual rights that were in play there. He also did photographs of naked children, interestingly enough, too. And those got him in trouble at showings of his photographs, especially in Cincinnati, Ohio, where it was obviously, well, not obviously, but it was in contravention of local law on these things. So this man, what he was doing was he was proceeding to show, I am talented. I can do photographs that are amazing. And I can also do photographs that are shocking beyond all belief. The bullwhip. And I can also do photographs that are shocking only to you because you have a certain perspective on the world. There is nothing horrific. Actually, the bullwhip, I'd say about, you polled 1,000 people, 999 of them would say this bullwhip is just wrong, and the one who didn't, you just get away from real fast. But as far as his photographs of nude underage children, that there was nothing sexual about them. They were just photographs. And they were photographs that tried to highlight the beauty of a human being. But they were illegal in with respect to Cincinnati law. What he was doing was he was essentially coming up against authority and saying, you tell me this isn't speech protected by the Constitution. Tell me that. And then come back at me and tell me this is a free country if you tell me that this is wrong and I am not allowed to do these things. Interestingly enough, in his time, Cincinnati's law ordinances at the local level were struck down. In the current era, they would be supported. In many cases, many of his photographs can now no longer be, at least some of his photographs cannot be shown anymore. Okay? And so times have changed. Your speech rights have contracted somewhat. The question is, how much have you lost? You're not allowed to do certain kinds of photographs. Now let me bring this to the next level. And this has to do with obscenity. In general, obscenity. The Supreme Court found some years back, and I'm going to ask you to please find that one for me, that free speech does not include what is considered obscene. Now what is considered obscene must meet a multi-point test. And I'm going to ask you, and as a matter of fact, I'll give you a resource before the night's over so you can actually research it yourselves. It's not hard. All you do is just find what's the test. One of the important, perhaps the strikingly noticeable piece of this multi-point test is that it recognizes prevailing community standards. So it is obscene if it is patently offensive, has no artistic or academic merit, and it is patently and it appeals to the prurient interests of the reader, and it does not meet community standards. So that means that something could be non-obscene one place, and right across a boundary, it could be obscene. You could go to prison on one side for showing this. You would not go to prison on the other side for showing this. That is complicated. That's complicated. Now, interestingly, one of the results of that, have you ever gone on the interstates and seen almost weird, out in the middle of nowhere. You'll see off one of the exits a big porn house, one of those adult magazine stores. Have you ever seen those on the interstate? You think, what the hell is that all about? Why here? Well, it's because they have the operation outside of the city boundaries of some city back along one of the roads. And what they're doing is they are keeping away from the community standards by placing their operation outside of the community. And therefore, they can then purvey their wares without concern for violating community standards. And they can sell to all the dirty old men and perverts in town who will just drive a few miles outside of town to buy their stuff. Here's the thing, though. Obscenity, the reason we our society frowns upon obscenity is ancient in origin. It has to do with the roots of comes from Judeo-Christian roots, but it's not just in our society, not just Judeo-Christian. There are many places in the world where it's considered, where there are gross things that are considered gross. The logic of it is that the society has a duty, first of all, to protect children from obscene, dirty materials and from the results of having obscene, dirty materials. Speaking as a parent, I certainly do not want to walk into a bookstore and have magazines with grotesque sex being shown on. On the other hand, I do not like the idea that I am not allowed to see this myself if that's my choice. On the other hand, I do not like the idea of creating a society that is so coarse that boys grow to be men thinking that that's what women are all about. So it's a complicated dynamic, and we ebb and flow. We've been in a very conservative period where we could not even show a breast with a pasty on it without the ABC getting fined for, that was the Janet Jackson thing. Now, when I was growing up, and I was your age, there was nudity on television. It was accidental, but there were bare people on TV. It wasn't anything horrific. It was just a free time. Now, you show a bare person on TV, and every religious person in the country is going to be writing to the FCC screaming for blood. So, it ebbs and flows. It ebbs and flows. So don't think that this is the end of it, although we do seem to be getting more and more conservative. I want to bring up, I'm not sure where I want to bring this up. I want to stay focused on the First Amendment just for a minute. With free speech, the concept of free speech applies to individual citizens. In 1942, the Supreme Court ruled that this free speech clause does not apply to corporations, to commercial speech. Commercial speech does not have constitutional protection. Commercial speech does not have constitutional protection. What happened after that is part of a larger evolution of law in this country that has been going on, where more and more the courts and the Supreme Court are recognizing corporations and other business entities as persons under the law. In fact, in this course, and I'll emphasize this later, when I use the word persons, oftentimes, I am actually referring to anything from a human being on through to an LLC, on through to a full-blown corporation, C corporation. The idea of the corporation as person is evolving. And leftists and many liberals just are having a fit with that. Companies are being given rights. Why? What the hell is that all about? And there is a good, strong argument as to why that is outrageous. I'm sure the founding fathers would not have been too thrilled with the idea. But it is coming about. By the 1970s, the SCOTUS was beginning to let up on commercial speech. And by that, and there were decisions in that time that have come to be understood as recognizing commercial speech has qualified constitutional standing. Constitutional protection, I'm sorry. Companies certainly have standing, or they can establish standing before the courts. So the logic is they certainly should be recognized as having protections under the Constitution when they are presented by the courts. Commercial speech is not as broad in its freedom as individual speech. So you got to keep that in mind, and I sometimes will ask some kind of a question on a quiz or a test about that. Commercial speech is not as broad as individual speech. However, commercial speech does include important aspects that are also in the rights of individuals in their speech. One of those is a qualified right to lie. In commercial speech, there is a term called puffing. You ever heard it? You ever heard of puffing? It's overstating without lying about your product. Now, if you take a course in marketing from me, you will hear about puffing. In fact, puffing is an art. And puffing is allowed. What does it mean for a detergent to make clothes cleaner than clean? What does it mean for the detergent to make the clothes whiter than white? Have you ever seen whiter than white? Oh, God damn, I'm blind. Now, why did you do that, man? I didn't need whiter than white. You will breed with women if you use our cologne. Indeed, you will be fertile in the loins. If you do not use oil of Olay, you will become wrinkled and gray and ugly, and you will die alone, an old crone, in the rain, in an alley, with a dog peeing on your ugly body. When you buy our car, you will get out of it and you will click your heels. Ah, God. You will hurt yourself clicking. Don't click your heels while your back's bothering you. Look, you will do you see these things in commercials. Have you ever seen a commercial where they did things that you know very well you will never do as a result of a product? Of course you have. That's puffing. It's allowed.
They say things like warnings, like real characters do not blah, blah, blah,
blah. That's exactly, as a matter of fact, it was just a little before your time. The auto manufacturer Isuzu had one of the most brilliant multi-year marketing campaigns in the history of advertising. It keyed around a fellow named Joe Isuzu, who was a smarmy car salesman for Isuzu. Now, Joe Isuzu was actually the actor David Leisure, who later showed up in shows like Third Rock from the Sun and some other ones. I believe he was in. I might be wrong about that. But in these commercials, Joe Isuzu, the salesman, would lie through his teeth about how great the Isuzu cars were. He would lie. He would say all these outrageous things about the car. And then there would be these disclaimers written across the bottom of the screen. It would say, he's lying. Our cars don't do this. Really, they don't. He's lying to you. But the humor aspect of it was phenomenal. It got to the point, he would say, you can buy this car for the change in your pocket. And then there would be a little sign, if you have $8,223 in quarters in your pocket, that is. Things like that. Lying, so you can have the disclaimers that will essentially get you off the hook. But in some cases, they don't even have to do a disclaimer. When they say cleaner than clean, we assume that you know very well that it won't be cleaner than clean. Okay. When they, this was again before your time, high karate. Did any of you ever hear of a cologne called High Karate? You put the on the commercial, a guy would put it on his face, and all of a sudden women would attack him. And he'd have to go into karate mode, chopping women to try to keep them from molesting him. I mean, no, the cologne didn't do that. I bought bottles of it and poured it. It didn't work worth a damn. I mean, it just made me stink. And it made my face burn, too. So, the McDonald's. A guy sued McDonald's because they used to have these signs giving a number in billions of the hamburgers they had sold. This fellow, who was mathematically inclined, calculated that it would be impossible by the physical laws of the universe to have sold that many burgers. It just could not happen by the laws of nature, by the laws of physics. There were not that many cows. There were not that many plants that made meat. There were not that many people who could eat hamburgers. He calculated that there would have to have been, nearly every person on earth would have to be eating like 20 hamburgers a day or something. It was, he actually established it can't happen. They put it on their signs. They're lying. That's illegal for them to lie. The court said, no, it's not. It's not meant to be taken literally. And only a fool would take it literally. Underneath it, yes, the court's right, but the court is not recognizing that by the very representation, it gives a sense that really it's not there. Billions? Whoa, I better not even talk about this then. You know, it must be billions, so surely it must be safe food. Puffing is allowed. You cannot lie directly. You cannot misrepresent directly, but you can puff. Now, what does that mean as far as exactly? Cleaner than clean's okay. Whiter than white's okay. It is okay to make it look like women will attack you for the if you use this cologne. It is okay to make it look like a car will make the occupants of it so happy that they no longer need their antidepressants. Okay, all those things. Yes, those are okay. How far can you go? You can go as far as the point where you directly lie and misrepresent. Short of that, you've got protection under the Constitution. You understand that you have the you have the right to lie. You can lie, as long, especially if the lie is not materially related to the sale of a product. That's commercial speech. But you could, there's someone that you want to go out with. You really like the guy, so you explain to him that you're extremely wealthy. You're actually from a noble family in Luxembourg, and you're slumming it here in the United States just for the time being. But once you get through college, you're going to inherit the fortune, and you're looking for the guy who will be your prince, literally your prince, when you go back and assume the throne in your monarchy. You can do it. Now, he might be really pissed when he finds out that after graduation, the two of you move into a trailer park. You could describe yourself on the internet in very, very attractive terms. Now, you're obviously a strapping, meaty young man. However, you could, I won't disagree with that, then four. But, I mean, you could say things about yourself that are, shall we say, overstated. Not just about your mind. Yes, good. I didn't want to have to go too far. Now, could someone sue you when they found out that you were a lying mofo? No. You see what I mean? Lying, in and of itself, we lie all the time. If lying were illegal, we would be all in a lot of trouble. That's all I want to harp on for commercial speech versus individual speech. Now, Congress may not establish a state religion. That's called the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment. The Free Exercise Clause states that the government cannot restrict the free exercise of a chosen religion. Here's the dilemma. Here's the problem. Clearly, there have to be some restrictions because people could otherwise claim that their illegal acts were in pursuit of the expression of their religious beliefs and have a safe harbor from the general laws of society. The fundamentalists Latter-day Saints, the FLDS, who claim that polygamy is their right, that it's part of their religion and therefore part of their rights. They are actually correct. They're not inventing that polygamy is part of their religion. It really is part of their religion in that the fundamentalists, the FLDS, it has been repudiated by the mainstream Latter-day Saints, the quote-unquote Mormons. It has been repudiated by them. However, the fundamentalists, their argument stands. It is not polygamy. It is not bigamy because it is protected under our right to exercise our religion as we see fit. And this is clearly old doctrine. It's not an invention of the new. It's not like saying, well, my religion says that I'm allowed to drop acid. That's clearly just looking for a safe harbor. However, when Native Americans of the plains and other parts of the country say part of our religion is to use peyote, which is a controlled substance, is the government interfering with the free exercise of religion? Because the peyote is the way that they open the gate in Vision Quest. It is not something that is new. It has been around long before white men came. So when the white men come and piss all over themselves about drugs, are they interfering with the Constitution they wrote, which said that it is okay to exercise your religion? But do you see the slippery slope? If we recognize their right to do this, then you're going to have every dope head, yeah, man, that's my religion too, man. I knew when I was in college, there were these crazy-ass girls who would have peyote parties. And then they would do phony witch things and Wicca and pagan stuff. And it was really cool because they did it without... Never mind. But do you understand that they were claiming this is my religion? Oh, quit it. That's not your religion. You're just a bunch of weird people. Knock it off. Where does the boundary happen? You see that you let people who legitimately do these things as part of their religion, and then every phony and charlatan and pothead and dopehead starts to want to do them too. Would you like to have three wives?
No, thank you.
Oh, okay. three wives whose part of their religion is to obey your every command. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
Okay. We're good. Okay, now... So if we were to allow the FDLS to do what is clearly an established old part of their original religion, are we opening the slope so that guys like you and you, and girls like you, what would be wrong with you having five husbands? Completely compliant. They are your slaves. Each wears a color-coded collar. But you see what I'm trying to get at, though, is a slippery slope. You let a legitimate claim to something go on, and then, of course, you have all the crazies and the creepies doing the same thing. Make no mistake about it. The Free Exercise Clause is qualified. The Establishment Clause... let me spell this. The Establishment Clause is unqualified. The Founding Fathers were not vague in their writings. They laid it out. There is going to be a wall of separation. And in fact, that term was first used in some of the Jefferson writing. There will be a wall of separation. People can exercise their religions. The government may not create a religion. For God's sake, we already saw that crap all through Europe since time immemorial. We don't want to do that here. However, interestingly enough, you still see the challenges all the time. Declare these legislators try to get pander to their religious base by trying to get laws passed declaring this a Christian nation. One of the candidates for president, Huckabee, he openly said that there should be a removal of the wall of separation. Mr. Huckabee, he graduated from a questionable college and he flunked out of seminary at a more legitimate school, and he is an expert on the Constitution, wants to tear down the wall of separation. That tells you the kinds of people who do that. If you read the Constitution as I assigned, you will see in there. Did you see that one where there can be no test, religious test for a public office? You saw that? That's cool. Again, the Constitution does not repeat itself very often. That was one place where you saw it. And if you see that, that means that that was something that was really important for the founding fathers to set out. And when you see that they don't want the government establishing a religion, and they don't want the government even doing religious tests for people, that tells you right there that this was serious for the founding fathers, and it should be just as serious for us in this country. That does not, I want to finish this with a little insight. There is a secretive brotherhood called Freemasonry. I'm a Mason. I am a Freemason. I'm a Master Mason. I'm part of this secret brotherhood. Yes, we're trying to take over the world. We plot, you know, everything. I'm sure you saw A National Treasure. The first one had a lot to do with Masonry. There was a wonderful, excellent Johnny Depp movie called From Hell that did a very cool theory about who Jack the Ripper was and his relationship to Freemasonry. But understand that the Freemasons, many of our founding fathers were Freemasons. Many of them were. We profess and honestly fealty to God. We do. We declare ourselves affiliated with a religion. Now, there are Christian lodges, Jewish lodges, even Islamic lodges in Freemasonry. But once you have gone through that part of the ritual where you swear the oath on the Bible and all that kind of stuff, you are taken into a really, really strange world where they explain to you what's behind Christianity, Judaism, Islamicism. All the religions are brought together. It's like an educational system, and it goes back hundreds of years. There's a movie out, and you can find it. I've actually posted it on one of my websites. The movie is called Zeitgeist. Or you could pronounce Zeitgeist. Or Zeitgeist, as some argue. I put it up on my website. It's about 2 hours long. And it is 2 hours of weirdness. And the people in the movie overplay the hand. They get into conspiracy theory weirdly. But if you can put up with the weird conspiracy theory crap, they actually do a phenomenal job of showing essentially the same things that our founding fathers would have accepted as fact. How these religions of the world are all bound together, and there's no huge distinction among religions. It's all a part of variations in myth based upon the present the culture that was using it. So if you can stomach the weirdness, they bring in the Federal Reserve, 9/11, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton. They get really out there. It's like an acid trip from the 60s in some ways. But they do in the early part of the movie, especially in the first 40 minutes, I'd say, they do a magnificent job of showing essentially what our own founding fathers as Freemasons would have learned, would have believed about religion, about Christianity, and a lot of other things. So when you see these things in the Constitution, that about trying to keep the government from getting involved in religion. It has a very deep background because our founding fathers weren't just thinking about the problems that religious involvement in Europe had caused for so many hundreds and hundreds of, for so many centuries. They were also thinking about their own training, their own education as Freemasons, as people who were in the quote-unquote age of enlightenment. Did any of you in high school or possibly in your previous college work read an essay by Thomas Paine called Age of Enlightenment? You did? You remember how he starts out very early in it. He says, I believe in God and no more. And then he goes through and he doesn't really trash religion, but he just says, this is not what we want to be about in this age of enlightenment. That's the kind of thinking these founding fathers had in the early Constitution. So I want to emphasize that in this course, if nothing else, before I get into business law, I want to get constitutional law set out and the mindset of our the founding fathers and what they were saying to us about their view of the person and his relationship to the state and where religion sat in that. This becomes important in commercial operations. For example, a big issue in Minneapolis and in other towns, big cities across the United States, is that many cab drivers in the cities are Muslims. And they want to pick up cab fares at the airports. The Muslims, and this came to a big boil in Minneapolis, they said, we will not let anyone into our cab who is carrying alcohol. Now, many people buy alcohol at the airport duty-free. And some of them say, we will not pick up a woman who is not modestly dressed. So, if you're not wearing a veil, if you are showing thigh, if you're showing immodesty, we're not going to pick you up at the airport. That's our religion. We just won't do it. And they say, your constitution says that we have the right to exercise our religion as we see fit. And you cannot establish, by saying that we have to pick them up, you are favoring religions where women can be, slutty. Okay? So what do you say? Who's right? Who's wrong? Our constitution says the government certainly cannot restrict the free exercise thereof. But in so doing, we're giving cab drivers licenses to show up at the airports and then deny access to passengers who are carrying booze, to passengers who are immodestly dressed women.
Are they saying that the cab companies fire them for not
picking up people? It's their own cabs. These are independents. Oh. Yeah, I actually used to be a hack myself, and you know, I work for a company. You turned out a fare, you're fired, you asshole. But you know, these are independents. That's a good question, though. But well, who's right here? Who would win in court? Is there a way around this problem? Well, I'll tell you how the city has dealt with it for now. You see, when you go up to these big airports, you, as a cab driver, you have to park in a long line and wait for a fare. And you just pull up, you get your turn. The Minneapolis, I believe it was, said, okay, if you turn down a fare, you have to go back to the back of the line and start all over again. Giving them an incentive. You can exercise your religion. You're just going to not make a whole lot of money that day. You go back to the back of the line. And they said, well, that's not fair, that you're economically punishing us for exercising our religion. So, what say you? The argument, okay, here, let me give you the outline of the argument. This is the argument of the city. This is public property. Public property does not allow the free exercise of religion. It allows for the neutrality of this public space for religious exercise. So now, when you are on this property and you are making money on this property, you are being given permission to make money through the payment of your licensing fee. And as such, by requesting and being given this license to operate your commercial enterprise, you are agreeing to the ground rules that say you may not preferentially promote your religion, but you may exercise it. So you may not harm another with your religion, but you may harm yourself if that's your religion. You may benefit yourself, you may harm yourself. You may benefit other people with your religion if you believe Good Samaritan kind of things, but you may not harm another person with your religious exercise. It would be so, for example, a crazed Christian who says, I must have people crucify themselves if they want my cab. And essentially, the same argument. It's that's a little extreme, but the point is, if you are on public property, you must follow public rules. That's all there is to it. And if you don't like that, well, tough darts. That's the way we do it. I want you to take a break now. Let me move on from the First Amendment. Well, let me first, before I do that, First Amendment, you also have the right, freedom of association. You also have the right to seek redress for grievances against the government. And those, again, and I said this previously, the Constitution is not granting you rights. When it lays out rights in the First Amendment and in other parts of the Constitution, what it is doing is enumerating the recognition of certain of your rights. In later parts of the Constitution, certainly in the Bill of Rights, it is essentially shaping a right that you have by natural law. In the Due Process Clause, for example, it is not saying that you have the right to due process. It is defining the government's interests with respect to what is otherwise a right by natural law. So keep that in mind. Again, I cannot emphasize that enough. The Constitution does not give you rights. And I've said this again, I'll say it after this too. The state cannot give you rights. Well, that would be very big of the state. And you watch it. Watch it. When the government, when the police, when politicians talk about rights as if they are giving and taking away rights, keep in mind, they cannot. And if they do take away rights, if they do refuse to recognize rights, they do so at risk of losing legitimacy. If they allow rights of some that are not conferred upon others, they are deeply scarring the rule of law. And the rule of law means The rule of law means
different person.
I promised I would back off if that happened. The rule of law means that's okay. This will be one of the things that I want you to. There's a tattoo parlor down by the on the outskirts of the university. Mm-hmm. Here, I want you to get this one tattooed on you. Okay. Go. Precisely, the law applies equally to everyone, whether you be king or commoner, whether you be great or small. Man or woman, adult or child, official or citizen without official status. The law applies equally to you. Don't come before the bar of justice and speak about your special rights that no one else has. Well, I am not allowed to give you this information because I've got national privileges. I can't testify before Congress because I would have to take an oath and I have executive privilege. Well, you see, sir, I can kill innocent civilians because I'm a police officer and we've got to get tough on crime. You heard about that crime, haven't you? We got to get tough on it so we can kill people at will. And the bar of justice cannot hold us accountable. Bull! That's not what the rule of law is about. The rule of law means that President Bush can go to prison just like you can. You can be the bunkmate of Large Marge. So too can the greatest official of this country. You can be the wife of Bubba for murdering. So too can a police officer who guns down a man who has no gun, who didn't do anything wrong. That is how the rule of law works. And to the extent that a society pulls itself away from the rule of law, that is the extent to which that society has diminished its legitimacy, and it can no longer rule by the will of the governed. It rules by sheer fist. Second Amendment is a mangled mess. The Second Amendment is a mangled mess. Yes, there is something about a right to keep and bear arms, but what the hell that was about, I cannot tell you. Let me read the Second Amendment to you and point out, and here I'm going back, I used to be an English teacher. I was a bitch as an English teacher. Grammarian. All that kind of stuff. You will not splice a comma. Here is the Second Amendment. There's the damn thing right there, yes. A well-regulated militia, comma. Okay. Now, what that usually would mean is we've set up a subject. The comma means that we're going to have what is called a non-restrictive clause that follows. Some explanation of that subject. Okay, before we get to the predicate. So we've got a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma. Okay, so far so good. There was a qualifying non-restrictive clause. The commas mean that it doesn't have to be in the sentence, but it is helpful. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Uh-oh. That sounds like another subject starting up. What the hell? Comma, a comma after subject, shall not be infringed. Where? Mr. Jefferson, we're not our first name. Mr. Jefferson, where the hell is the subject? Is it a well-regulated militia? Shall not be infringed? Now, that doesn't make sense. So, is it being necessary to the security of a free state? No, that's not even a subject. That's some kind of a fragment. Okay, so the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Ah, but why would there be a comma after that? And what is a well-regulated militia? You wouldn't put a comma after a subject, even a late 18th century writer, and they were rather free with their commas, would surely have known a confusion because it looks like there are two different subjects. A well-regulated militia shall not be infringed, or the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Comma, shall not be infringed. Now, late 18th century writers, I'm being a little bit harsh here. They did have a bad habit, even good ones, of putting commas right after subjects before verbs, before the verb part began. It's possible that's what he was after there. But, so, he might have been saying the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged, which would mean that that comma is just sort of like an artifact of late 18th century writer. But why did he bring up this part about the militia? Is that important to this amendment? Is the right of the people to keep and bear arms unqualified, or is the militia and the existence of these militias a qualification on the right if the militias do not exist, or if the people are not members of the citizens' militias, does that mean that the right does not exist? Who knows? It's been enough to keep pro-gun advocates and anti-gun advocates on their toes for a long, long time. It is clear that in this era, there was a considerable amount of concern about weaponry for a couple of reasons. Weapons were a part of life because if you didn't have a gun, a long rifle or something, you probably didn't eat meat very often if you were out in the countryside at all. Now, if you were in the city and you were wealthy, you got your meat. But most of the citizenry of the country at that time shot their food. So that would have been one thing. Another thing was that in this era, King George had been trying to put restrictions on weaponry in the hands of the people because those weapons could be used to shoot his troops. And so there was an increasing amount of restriction on weaponry. One interesting thing was that it was in this period that certain technologies of rifling were starting to develop. The boring so that the bullet would go more accurately. It was not awesome. I mean, you were lucky to kill anything with those rifles. It was an accident to kill people sometimes, but there were laws being or edicts being put down by King George. This is not something that we want you people doing. So you may not create these high-powered weapons because you might use them on my troops, and all my troops are doing is trying to maintain civil order. Does that sound familiar to an argument that we have now in our time? Oh, we can't have assault rifles because they can be used on police officers, and there's no other reason to have an assault rifle except for the purposes of being a police cop killer or a domestic terrorist of some kind. So it's interesting that the same concerns that were driving restrictions on gun ownership back at this time are still around to this day, haven't changed. Next amendment that I am interested in is the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no, do you see, by the way, did you see that comma right after the subject again there? That artifact of the late 18th century writers, you've got to be careful about that thing, shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by an oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So now, when the FBI issues a national security letter, which gives essentially the power of a search without a court order, and it gives it to an internet service provider, we want all of the information about all of your clients and where they have gone on the internet. What say you about that kind of thing with respect to what you are reading in the plain language of the Fourth Amendment? What do you say? Let me read it again. Persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched. That's not the internet service provider. That's the person that they are trying to find out information about. And they do this all the time. Everywhere you're going, they can issue a national security letter. It is not reviewed by a court. It's just, well, we think, we promise that there's something we need to find here. So, if you go to, you are being tracked. Sneak and peek. Have you heard of sneak and peek? They now have the right to come into your place without telling you that they are coming, without telling you that they are there, without telling you that they have been there. Look around. And then get out. And you might never know it happened. Those are allowed now. They are allowed. Sneak and peeks. New technology. Already out there. A scanner that the police can hold in front of a house from across the street, and they can see everything you're doing inside. They can look from outside. Oh, well, we don't need a warrant because we're not going in. Coming right now. I was telling people about this a few years ago on my websites, and they said, nah, now they're starting to show up. Scanners, you're driving along, I can see everything that's happening with you. I can tell about what you carry, if you're carrying your driver's license. I'll be able to tell if you are using alcohol or drugs without ever even stopping your car just as you go by. I'll be able to tell if you have eaten your green beans. I will be able to tell if you've had a bowel movement, maybe. Can you imagine that? We don't need a search warrant. We're not stopping anyone. When you go to the airport, the scanners at the big airports now look at your naked body. How do you like? Well, I mean, yeah, sure, yeah, that they'll admire me. But I for most, how do you feel about that? How will you feel when your 10-year-old daughter goes through that scanner and some old guy is sitting there? Oh yeah, some TSA. Oh well, we've got to trust them. They're public officials. They're allowed to do that. What do you think? You can see this Constitution with your own eyes. So can every citizen of this country. Amendment 5. There are two important things in Amendment 5. There's the right against self-incrimination. Okay? Big one. Big one. They can't make you incriminate yourself. They can't make you do that. You can refuse to. But there's also another one. This is the one where essentially you have the habeas concept. But let me ask you this. Does the Constitution mention habeas corpus? Did you see it? Where was it? Okay, let's put it in the context of the Constitution. Page 728. 728. Well, spank me, Jesus. Where did you say that was?
Article 1, Section 9.
Very good, very good. I just wanted to make sure you know. It's not even in the amendments. It wasn't even an afterthought. It was recognized right there in the core of the document. So what do you say? The Attorney General of the United States, the chief law enforcement officer, the head of the Department of Justice, under oath, said to the Senate Judiciary Committee that the Constitution does not give an express grant of habeas corpus. What say you? That's right. It's not. Either he is a blithering idiot or he lied under oath. And he lied about the Constitution under oath. One or the other. The chief law enforcement officer and the head of the Department of Justice under oath misrepresented the Constitution of the United States with respect to the privilege of habeas corpus. That's scary. That is, it's not tragic, it's scary. Okay, double jeopardy. Do you see that one in Amendment 5? Did you see double jeopardy mentioned there? And in Amendment 5, they bring up the concept of the grand jury. Now, I briefly mentioned grand jury, but I need to bring it up a little bit more right now. A grand jury hears evidence presented by prosecutors and then determines whether or not the evidence is sufficient to issue an indictment. The threshold you might want to think of as clear and compelling, the lowest. And all that does is compel the court to invite the indicted, the invitation is rather mandatory, to appear to answer to the charges in the indictment. A grand jury merely issues indictments. Petit juries hear the evidence and render verdicts. Now, there are federal grand juries and some states have grand juries. Some states have abandoned the grand jury system because it is, in many people's minds, in legal scholars' minds, extraordinarily abusive. You can just be abused in front of a grand jury. I can speak to that myself. I was brought before a grand jury. I wasn't under suspicion or indictment. I was just brought in as a witness. I was bullied. I was terrorized. I was threatened with jail. I did not have the right to have an attorney with me. I did not have the right to invoke my Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. They can be horrible. and prosecutors use them monstrously. I have had friends of mine who have served on federal grand juries describe horror stories about prosecutors and what they do. In one case, a woman was bullied so badly that she ended up in the hospital with emotional breakdown because a prosecutor felt that she had done some research outside of the grand jury about a case, so he dragged her into a room and kept her there for 5 hours, in which period of time he brought in a court reporter twice and grilled her with yelling, and literally she said it was screaming at her. A man I know very well described a federal prosecutor who hauled him into a room and then badgered him because he wasn't issuing enough indictments. He was voting against indictments in too many cases. These have led over the years to some states abandoning grand juries. As a matter of fact, years ago there was an odd episode of a TV show called The Rockford Files in which the main character was in the situation of being called before a grand jury to testify. And the show actually presented the awful things that can happen to innocent people when overzealous prosecutors have these grand juries that they can essentially have fun with. The old rule of thumb is that a grand jury, a prosecutor can force a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich if he wants. That's just the way it is. An alternative to the grand jury system of indictments is a system where charges are filed via a bill of information. This is much more common in many cases. You wouldn't be charged on a bill of indictment. You would be charged on a bill of information. It'll be by one of these kinds of methods. In fact, and I've actually had my head eaten by a couple of my legal beagle friends about this, but I'll stand by it. A traffic ticket is actually a bill of information. You snort. You may snort, but that's what it is, essentially. It's laying out the charges against you and inviting you to appear before a court to answer to the charges or to admit your guilt and walk away from it. Now, when you are brought before the petit jury, you have three different pleas you can make. You can plead not guilty, in which case there will be a trial. Now, you can have either a trial by jury. You are given that right. Do you remember, by the way, where that right is in the Constitution? Trial by a jury of your peers? You have the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed. Amendment 6. But you don't have to. You can actually, as the accused, opt for a bench trial, which in some cases that would be heard just before the judge. There are several reasons why that might be a good idea. If the charges against you are emotional, then it might be very difficult to find a jury that would be able to hear the charges properly. Also, a complex trial, assuming that most people, they might not be stupid, but they would not be able to grasp all of the complexities that are involved, you might opt for a bench trial. On the dark side, the New York police officers who shot to death the three innocent, shot to death one of those innocent men, wounded another, they fired many bullets. They chose a bench trial because they knew the judges in their in that district were particularly favorable to police officers. They had found out that when juries in New York heard their cases, they hanged them. But years ago, they figured out, we'll just opt for bench trials because the judges like us. The judges will be fair to us. The judges will not be swayed by the fact that we killed an innocent man. So, go ahead. If you're the accused.
Just somebody.
If you're the accused, you get to choose. You get to opt. Yeah.
But didn't you say that the judge judge could still overturn the jury's verdict?
Indeed, the judge could, but that was in civil.
Okay.
It's better not to do that in any situation. I was referring to civil cases. Here it's criminal. An indictment would be a criminal case. Remember that indictments are for crimes. Crimes are wrongs against society that are prosecuted by the society's representatives in the court system, in the legal system. Okay. Moving, and then Amendment 6, again, you have the right to be confronted and informed of the nature and cause of the accusations, of course. This is a big one because the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, many of them still do not know what they are charged with. That's a state secret. If we told them what we were charging them with, well, then we would reveal national secrets. So they can't know what they are charged with. They're just rotting in prison. That's clearly unlawful under the unconstitutional. You have to be confronted with the witness against you. This is a complicated one. The courts have allowed some variation in that. In cases where children are the witnesses, there is an interest in protecting them from being chewed out by a defense attorney. But at the same time, you have to balance that against the rights of the accused to confront, to face his accusers. It gets really complicated in those regards. Whose rights are higher here? And unfortunately, if you were to just take the plain language of the Constitution itself and look at it, witnesses are not addressed. It is the accused that is the subject of the Sixth Amendment. Right to speedy trial, right to public trial. The military commission's trials are not covered. They are not public. The original trials that were held at Guantanamo Bay, the judges actually wore black hoods, just like the creepy-ass stuff you see in bad B-movie, spy movies and all that. Oh, well. Then you have the right to assistance of counsel. Now, do you notice this is essentially the Miranda warning. A lot of this is. Fifth and sixth are Miranda. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can't even be able to... And that was, Miranda was the decision, technically Miranda v. Arizona, that was handed down by the Supreme Court years ago. The case you have at bar right now for case one is the Supreme Court's 21st century revisiting of Miranda v. Arizona, because these extreme conservatives and right-wingers were excited about getting that off the books, having the Supreme Court say, we don't have to do that anymore. Interestingly, in Dickerson v. United States, they said, we still need to be able to tell. We still need police to tell people that. Because as great as people's duty is to know the Constitution, we certainly cannot expect that they will know it in all of its details. And it is important that not only do the police inform the defendant of this, but perhaps underneath that the message is the police need to know this themselves. We see in shows like NYPD Blue all the fun things that you can do to get around the rights of us. And it's fun to bust these bad guys, but Supreme Court says there are still some rules we have to follow. Now, Amendment 7, suits of common law. That's, in other words, lawsuits. We're not talking Amendment 7 about crimes. We're talking about lawsuits. Threshold, you may bring a case if it's for more than $20. Yeah, you can. It's right there. They didn't account for inflation, of course, but at the same time, it's pretty cool. You have the right as a common person to seek redress against other citizens for grievances, for wrongs against you. You have the right for a court to hear your suit at common law. And then let me move a little bit here. Amendment 9. Amendment 9 is the one that's the negative blanket. Remember I told you about how if the Constitution does not arrogate specifically to the federal government some right, then that right remains with the states and the citizens thereof. This is Amendment 9. It is sitting there blinking like a flashlight. If the Constitution does not mention it as being circumscribed by federal law, by the federal government, then it belongs to the people. This is what I meant when I said the Constitution does not grant rights. It merely enumerates issues that must be addressed in terms of circumscribing rights for the common good. And Amendment 10 is more of that kind of thing. I want to revisit very quickly, and then we'll end this. Amendment 14, two important parts. The due process matter is revisited. Remember how the due process issue shows up in previous amendments? And here it is again. And recall what I said. When the Constitution brings up a matter more than once, that's a doubly important matter. And the due process is right there in the 14th Amendment. But there's also another thing in the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. Equal protection. The 14th Amendment made sure that after we had gotten slavery off the table as a viable thing in the United States, we were not going to allow this country to ever slip back to an era when there were people and then there were parts of people. Did you see that early in the Constitution? How they counted Negroes as... wasn't that funny? What the hell is that? What? I mean, if I saw two-thirds of a person driving by, God! The logic, by the way, what had happened, that was actually the North that pulled that stunt because all the slaves, the Negroes, were in the South and they didn't want them counted because that would have made the South have disproportionate representational power. So it was the Northerners who didn't want that, the Negroes counted as whole humans. And then in the 1850s, the Supreme Court of the United States got all kinds of excited and Dred Scott, the awful Dred Scott decision was made. Did you learn about Dred Scott in high school or any place? It's one of those, so much important history is disappearing, and I bring it up again. Dred Scott was the one where essentially the Supreme Court said, I'll just put it in a nutshell. No, Negroes don't have the right not to be slaves. Sorry. Look at the Constitution. We're counting them as pieces of people. What the hell? Constitutionally, they have no claim that that they cannot be held as slaves. So essentially, send that slave back to the South. That was essentially what Dred Scott was all about. Now, this set up a brutal constitutional confrontation. This was the context of the Civil War. Brutal confrontation. Because essentially, Abraham Lincoln had to defy and essentially, he essentially told the Supreme Court, go F yourself. And he did it very clearly. And he didn't do it once. He did it on several occasions in very short succession. When the ugliness came to a head, Abraham Lincoln turned into essentially a tyrant. He dismissed orders of the Supreme Court. One was shocking was that he repeatedly denied habeas corpus, the privilege of habeas corpus, to some Southern prisoners. He just denied it. Southern military people, which is just awful when you do that. And so you might, if you ever run into some of my writings, I am not a giant fan of Abraham Lincoln. Yes, the ends were great, but what he did was just shocking. And it set up the current Supreme Court to be able to say that some of the things that the current president is doing are okay, because we now know that in retrospect what Abraham Lincoln did as essentially a unitary executive were okay too. Lincoln had reshaped the Supreme Court. Essentially, the Supreme Court became much more compliant to him after Lincoln kicked its ass in the early 1860s. It became completely compliant and rubber-stamped authoritarian decisions. Now, those vanished into history for a long, long time, But they've popped back up. And one of your later cases in this course, you're going to see the modern Supreme Court affirming something that is rather disturbing, and there that was essentially something that the president did. And there you're going to see them. The only place they can point is to this Lincoln, this decision in favor of Lincoln. That's the only place you can find it. So you've got to be a little careful about this, because you're going to see that there, the seeds of good society that we had coming about in Amendment 14, in the much later in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and all that, they have some dark, dark origins, some very bleak times in our history. Equal Protection Clause, due process in the 14th Amendment. So that's important, all, especially for the Due Process Clause. And there are some other amendments too. There's this one, there's this weird one in here about giving women the right to vote. Shocking, but it's there. Kind of weird. Our freedom-loving democracy was not interested in giving women the right to vote until when was it? Your female ancestors had the right to vote? Since the beginning of the country? When was it? The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. That's Amendment 19, 1920. So it's been less than 100 years, less than 90 years, that women have had the vote in this country. So that gives you an idea. We are still working on some things. I will now issue the quiz. When you are finished with it, you are free to leave. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.